Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we've lost Paul Venable for the show. And I don't know if he'll be back tomorrow. I received a text from him early this morning that he has basically been bedridden. He started coming down with sneezes and so forth, and now he has a fever. So our wishes out to him will just continue on because it's still Constitution Month or season. And before I get into today's show, let me kind of emphasize how spoiled we have been, or I should say how spoiled our great-great-great-grandparents were, because they had a system where they could ignore their government, and they created complacency, and how spoiled they became that as government started turning towards the end of the 1800s, and when I say started turning, I literally mean really started turning in the 1870s and just got worse and worse and worse due to the Bar Association, due to our justice system. We have literally, we're at a point. We saw the United States president try to redefine the word is perjury just to avoid being held accountable. And he was being held accountable over the most minor charge they could have brought forward. And what I mean by that, folks, is that there was testimony in Congress providing a clear timeline of how the Clinton administration was basically pandering and providing money and actually providing intelligence to the Chinese Communist Party for money for his re-election campaign. And when you look at how much money he received in that congressional report, you'll absolutely be flabbergasted. Now, so one of the things that amazes me is, you know, people point to the 1967 Democratic fiasco on the floor of Congress in the House of Representatives and how they grandstanded, the Democrats, how they grandstanded against the 14th Amendment. Now, I hope a lot of people hear this. They grandstanded against the 14th Amendment all the while they were using the 14th Amendment against we the people. They used the argument of the 14th Amendment regarding the Establishment Clause and applied, because see, the Establishment Clause, folks, only applied originally in the Bill of Rights, and all of the Bill of Rights only applied to the federal government. It wasn't until the 14th Amendment that you could start applying those things. So when it came down to the Scopes trial in 1920, the federal government basically came down and said, look, this violates the separation of church and state, and they started running with that. Actually, the separation of church and state came a little bit later. But this is where they actually made a law in dictating what was going to be taught in school regarding religion, that Christianity or creationism would not be taught, and that we would be brainwashed with Darwinism and evolution. And over time, they used the 14th Amendment to remove your Bible from the school. They used the 14th Amendment to remove our prayers from the school. When I say your Bible, I mean ours. They've used the 14th Amendment to remove the Bible and any Christian symbol in the courts, in any local courts, in any local governments, and they've removed the crosses, not that I'm a fan of crosses, but they've removed the crosses from public view. They've even demanded the removal of crosses from public insignias and public, you know, logos or seals or what have you. And they used the 14th Amendment to basically attack Christianity. Now, why am I telling you all of this? Because we're being told by conservative lawyers that the 14th Amendment doesn't apply that way. We're being told that the privileges and immunities doesn't, you know, provide any protection from U.S. citizens. But, oh, it will protect the atheists. I'm a little bit frustrated. I'm a little bit keyed up. I'm a lot pissed. And more details will come. But we're going to be having our national call tonight, and we're going to talk quite a bit about this. And just due to the fact that we're at this alone. I mean, so we had our great-great-great-grandparents who, you know, became complacent, and we allowed, or they allowed themselves to just let the government start redefining everything by the mid, or actually in 1870 and on. They started redefining the 14th Amendment. And I've got all the evidence. This is going into why counties matter most. And why is all of this going? Because I'm putting a lot of information into this article just due to the fact that when the government recognizes a real weapon, in other words, they recognize a vulnerability, the evil forces circle the wagons and they really go, you know, and they create this defensive posture. But they understand the best defense is a good offense, and they start attacking, and they've been attacking and attacking us with unconstitutional laws, unconstitutional powers, and I could go on and on and on. The sad fact of the matter is that we're now at a point where I've been telling you our court system is absolutely corrupt. You might have this little small bastion out in, you know, suburbia somewhere or out in some dark red state. But I'm telling you that what we're finding, even in the dark red states, is the court system. Montana, when I was out there, it was pretty clear that the court system had been fully corrupted. Fully corrupted in Montana. While everybody's just sleeping, thinking how important it is that we have conservative people in our representation, they have completely lost sight of the importance of constitutionalism with every public servant from our legal system all the way down to our representatives. So with that, it falls upon us. And I can't tell you enough, if we fail to actually take the stand, or if we fail to stand up, I should say, against this tyranny, we have all the power to do so, even though they're telling us. See, here's another application of the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment supposedly gives people to go out and protest and destroy public property. Nobody gets arrested. No one gets arrested. But when we've had people out in Virginia, and I'm going to create a wall of shame, and we're going to create a wall of dividers. And I want people to understand that there are companies out there that don't care about your constitutional rights. They actually want to take a stand and shut us down. And they will they'll call the police on us, and they do nothing regarding the rioters. And the police will do nothing regarding the rioters. Oh, but because we're a law-abiding citizen, they'll be happy to process us and hold us fully accountable. Interesting. Folks, we're at that point. I mean, you know, you hear people yelling, wake up, wake up. I don't know, you know, whether you've got the testicle fortitude. I'm kind of concerned. I can't do all of this. I really can't. And it just, you hear me say this, I'm so proud of all of the people I work with and all the people that are out there taking time out of their day to stand up and do these things. But without you, without a movement, we're doomed. I am telling you, we've only got so much time to get a movement going. And I'm tired of people coming, you know, and getting involved. And because I get people getting involved and they want to inject political theatrics. Well, let's try to get some consensus and let's talk about, and they want to actually talk and waste time about going into the court system. We need people to start working with your county commissioners and or replacing your county commissioners. We need immediate action in your counties. We need to start flipping counties so that we can start flipping states. We've already got good people in state legislatures, but we just don't have enough. And, you know, the verdict is not in yet regarding the Freedom Caucus. You know, I've dealt with the Freedom Caucus in one particular state, but I'm getting stonewalled by the Freedom Caucus in many states. So don't think that the Freedom Caucus or any type of organization actually has your back. The Constitution has your back. And if you demand that your public servant actually takes a stand in supporting the Constitution and demanding full compliance of the Constitution, now you've got a government or a public servant who's got your back. Because if they're actually demanding full compliance of the Constitution, they do have your back. Now, when we left off yesterday, we were talking about the 17th Amendment. And how the 17th Amendment did not change as we read through this. These were the words that were changed out of Article 3. Because they're, when you look at the color-coded Constitution, they're actually italicized. The words that are changed by the amendment are italicized. So when we look at Section 3, it says this, that the Senate of the United States shall be composed of two senators from each state. Then it's italicized, chosen by the state legislature thereof. Well, the 17th Amendment changed that. Those few words changed that. And then in the next paragraph, the other words were changed. And if vacancies happened by resignation or otherwise during the process of the legislature of any state, the executive thereof may take temporary appointments until the next meeting of the legislature, which shall then fill such vacancies. So in other words, they just removed the legislature out of there. There is nowhere else in Section 3 that the 17th Amendment has changed their roles and responsibilities. They are still those few people to actually represent the state legislature on issues in Congress. In other words, those senators are required to offer and provide suffrage for your state legislators. And when we get to Article 5, which I'm going to do right now, because I'm going to get to that, because Article 5 protects this process. When you read Article 5, the very last line, because this is what we call the Amendment Protection Clause. As a matter of fact, you talk to a constitutional lawyer and you ask them about the Amendment Protection Clause, they'll look at you with this stare. Well, what are you talking about? And this is what it says. Provided that no amendment, which may be made, and then they talk about two types of amendments. Prior to the year 1808, shall in any manner affect the first and fourth clauses in the ninth section of the first article, and that no state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate. Now, when they talk about the state without its consent, they're not talking about the state of the people. They're talking about the state legislature, because who has suffrage in the Senate under this Constitution? It was already identified in the ratification debates that the suffrage was the state legislature, that suffrage in the House of Representatives was for the people of the state. This is why we had bicameral legislative bodies, to ensure the representation was equally apportioned to the two sovereigns underneath this body government. In other words, underneath the federal government, we had a House of Representatives that represent the people of the state, and then we had a Senate that represented the state legislature, the government of the state. And in so doing, we had a check and balance, and that check and balance still needed to be applied. But the 17th Amendment supposedly changed everything. And I'm telling you, it didn't change what they're telling you it changed. Because this here is the 17th Amendment. The Senate of the United States, this is the language of the 17th Amendment. You show me here where they no longer have to represent the state's interest and provide suffrage for the state legislature. Show me. And you won't find it. This is the language. The Senate of the United States shall be composed of two senators from each state, elected by the people thereof for 6 years, and each senator shall have one vote. The electors in each state, in other words, the representatives, remember we talked about the use of electors, they were talking about representatives. The electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislature. When vacancies happen in the representation of any state in the Senate, the executive authority of such state shall issue writs of election to fill such vacancies, provided that the legislature of any state may empower the executive thereof to make temporary appointments until the people fill the vacancies by election as the legislature may direct. This amendment shall not be construed as to affect the election or term of any senator chosen before it becomes valid as a part of the Constitution. So we can't have it both ways, folks. In other words, we can't have the 17th Amendment actually changing the process and also changing the responsibility when it doesn't. And that's what they wanted you to believe, because the guy that wrote this was an idiot. He didn't know that Article 5 had that amendment protection clause in it, or they would have addressed it. Believe you me, anybody that wants to be thorough wants to make sure they cross their T's and dot their I's. You're talking to a guy that suffers in the details regarding these First Amendment petitions. I just had a meeting last night in Georgia. Why are these petitions so long, and why are you going into so much detail? Because we need to cover the history, we need to cover the intent, the meaning, and what's the expected, and so forth. And so we do have abstracts, and we're seeking now. I mean, because we only have a few of these petitions that have abstracts, and so I'm hoping that we get the rest of these petitions with abstracts to them so we can continue on. I'm going to do more. I'm going to do as much as I possibly can. Maybe, and there's no doubt in my mind, I could probably do a lot more, but the time that it would take for me to do that would take a lot of my other responsibilities as a husband, as a father, and so forth. I mean, I'm burning the midnight oil here in trying to help other people understand what they need to do, having meetings and so forth, folks. We need your help. And so let me get back to Article 1, and we're going to go into Section 3 again. And now we're going to get into the qualifications of a senator. No person shall be a senator who shall have attained to the age of 35 years and been 9 years a citizen of the United States, and who shall not, when elected, be an inhabitant of the state for which he is chosen. Party qualification primaries are not listed. So we kind of covered this. We didn't cover the details of the 17th Amendment before. So what I want to do right now is I want to go back and excoriate how the parties have actually created this barrier to entry so that they can actually down-select and play games before the actual election so that they make sure that the person that represents the party, not you, the people. See, prior to this, right, prior to the 17th Amendment, the state legislatures were the ones that actually chose who was going to be their senator. The party, there was no primary, right? There was no primary whatsoever. They actually looked at nominees and they just, okay, this person seems to be the best to go. And I'll bet you anything, as a matter of fact, when I look at the Senate, up until the 17th Amendment, we had some pretty stellar senators. I'm not impressed. I am not impressed by the Senate today. I look at the Senate as probably one of the most highly paid for offices in the world. And as a matter of fact, that's probably why the average Senate race today is well over $1 billion. The average Senate race is well over $1 billion. That's that's hard to fathom, folks. I mean, we're looking at who's paying for that? Who's spending that kind of money to throw, you know, all of these ads out? And it's ironic that it has nothing to do with the people. The people aren't paying for that. The people are eating what the globalists are paying for, because every single one of these seats, the globalists are involved in it, because that's where the money's coming from. Even if it is the few conservative globalists, because they're out there, supposedly they're conservative, but they're not. Which is why on January 6th in the Senate, we heard a lot of grandstanding by buffoons about, oh, well, we want to have an investigation. We need to set up an investigation regarding the election. And Pence had nothing to do with it. Pence shut it down. But, you know, the bottom line is, which the words that should have been said was that this Electoral College is a violation of the U.S. Constitution, because 31 states, they had the documents in their hands, 31 states violated it. And nobody held Pence to task. Nobody. They all danced around on voter fraud and election fraud instead of the violations of the Constitution. Now, I know, folks, that there was a lot of voter fraud and election fraud, but that doesn't play in the U.S. Senate. Not that it can't play. We've actually got documentation, empirical data, that Congress has actually been involved in election fraud cases regarding the House of Representatives. It's not that they can't do it, but when it comes to the election of the president, that process is clearly defined by the Constitution, not by the election process of a state. And so it's one thing to talk about all the other elections, but when it comes to the choosing of the electors and how they are to vote, that is defined right there in the Constitution. That has nothing to do with election fraud. Just because the states are violating the Constitution regarding the Electoral College, well, okay, so we all look at the popular vote and the election fraud and voter fraud. Folks, we have no business. We've already gone through this, and we'll go through this even more when we get into Article 2. We have no business voting on a ballot for the president. We're supposed to be choosing our electors. You know, they constantly, you ask them why they do certain things. Well, the Constitution mandates we do that. Well, hold on here. Let's go to the Electoral College. It mandates that this is what's supposed to happen, and you're not following that. Oh, well, we've created, no, you can't create laws to change something in black and white. But anyway, let me move on. The Vice President of the United States, this is still part of Section 3, the Vice President of the United States shall be President of the Senate, but shall have no vote unless they be equally divided. This, in other words, he's the tiebreaker. The Senate shall choose their officers and also a president pro tempore in the absence of the vice president. So in other words, the president pro tempore is just a temporary, you know, filler in the seat when the president's traveling and so forth and he's gone. But 9 times out of 10, when a critical vote comes up, the vice president has to have his little happy self right there in the chair to be able to break the tie, especially if it's a progressive bill, because I can't think of a vice president we've had. I can't think of a vice president that we've had that's actually been a constitutionalist and has done the right thing. And that says a lot, because even with Reagan, look, we had deep state originator builder George H.W. Bush. So let's you know, be realistic here. The whole Senate, as far as the vice president goes, has always had this I'll just say a deep state, you know, reigns on it ever since the 17th Amendment and ever, well, as long as the parties have been controlling the choosing of the president and vice president. But with that, we're going to go into a break. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416. Okay, so got to turn the mute off. So we're going to get into a violation that's in the color-coded Constitution. I actually should make a little note here because this part of the Constitution being identified as violated was really identified by, I believe, John Rowland. So John Rowland was the former attorney general, and I believe that this portion, let me read it first, and I'll tell you where this came from. So anyway, so the Senate shall choose their officers. This is not the violated part. It's about the impeachment process. But anyway, the Senate shall choose their officers and also a president pro tem in the absence of the vice president or when he shall exercise the office of the president of the United States. The Senate shall have the sole power to try all impeachments. When sitting for that purpose, they shall be on oath or affirmation. Now, the rest of this, going to the end of Section 3, is considered, it's highlighted, yellow as a violation. Not an egregious violation, but a violation. When the President of the United States is tried, the Chief Justice shall preside, and no person shall be convicted without the concurrence of two-thirds of the members present. Judgment in cases of impeachment shall not extend further than to removal from office and disqualification to hold and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States, but the party convicted shall nevertheless be liable and subject to indictment, trial, judgment, and punishment according to the law. Now, why is this being violated? Because now let's think about it. When is the last time we actually went all the way through to an impeachment process? See, Nixon did not get the impeachment process, right? He actually resigned. Clinton stood his ground and was impeached and then was not convicted by the Senate. I believe the impeachment that is highlighted here where it was actually violated, because I'm not sure in the time of Bill Clinton's whether the Chief Justice, you know, was, you know, whether they followed it per se. But I do know that the impeachment of Andrew Johnson, the vice president of Lincoln, that was the, I'll just say, the scoundrel in the presidency with the radical Republicans, you know, at it, you know, going at odds with each other. But I believe that that process of the guilt and everything else, because I, if I remember correctly, the impeachment was over the dismissal of a secretary that supposedly, it was a political dismissal, and in other words, they demanded that, because Andrew Johnson wanted to get rid of a secretary of of an executive department. And this basically they charged him with impeachment because they basically said he couldn't do that. And I believe that instead of bringing the Chief Justice in, they just went ahead and tried him without and supposedly successfully impeached him. But as the law books kind of report, or I should say as history reported, he was that impeachment was repudiated because the president does have discretion of changing his executive departments, where the overall impeachment said that, no, they can't do that. And there's really, when we get through Article 1, we'll find that it is the discretion of the president of who's going to be sitting in those offices. That person doesn't necessarily have to resign. They can be fired. So anyway, Section 4 of Article 1, this starts off with a violation. The times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. In other words, that's not happened. And what I mean by that is the times, place, and manner of holding elections is actually been, I'll just say, obfuscated or has been taken by the parties. Because when it comes to the electors, that's a part of this. It's not just senators and representatives, but it's the electors as well. They don't include the electors, but that's when we're supposed to choose the electors. The times, places, and manners of holding elections for the senators and representatives, and that also goes with the president. So anyway, every other election cycle, the state legislature has the responsibility of including the electors, and they don't do that. They actually have parties, and they have party primaries. But the Congress may at time, by law, make or alter regulations except to the places of choosing senators. Now, this is not being violated, and it was amended by the 20th Amendment. The Congress shall assemble at least once every year, and such meetings shall be on the first Monday in December, which is, again, that part was modified by the 20th Amendment, unless they shall by law appoint a different day. Section 5, starting right off with a violation. Each house shall be the judge of the elections, returns, and qualifications of its own members. They are not. They're absolutely not. And as a matter of fact, there have been many that have been chosen and brought in, like Oman or Ilya, whatever, from Minnesota. Many. There have been many times they've turned their head to allow a party operative to come into office. And a majority of each shall constitute a quorum to do business, but a smaller number may adjourn from day to day and may be authorized to compel the attendance of absent members in such manner and under such penalties as each house may provide. Now, so I have a problem with some of this when I look at the fact that they have zero oversight. I believe that they did it this way because they had to. Circumstances dictated that the states could not monitor and oversee these representatives, both their Senate and the House of Representatives. And that was true. We couldn't see, and we had no ability to engage them on a minute's notice when all of a sudden they were gone in dismissal on a sabbatical or whatever. And I believe that there's a reason, there's a good, compelling reason for the states to be able to step in and basically say, you need to conduct business, or in some cases, you need to adjourn because the business you're doing is not business at all of the federal government. And basically start forcing those types of issues, because how many committees does the House and the Senate, host and operate that are not within the powers of the federal government? In other words, they're creating business that they have no business creating. Anyway, Section 5. And this is where we talked about the qualifications coming in and the majority of doing business. But the next paragraph or the subparagraph underneath this is egregiously violated. Each house may determine the rules of its proceedings, punish its members for disorderly behavior, and with the concurrence of 2/3, expel a member. This right here, which should have been actually modified by the 14th Amendment, Section 3. And I actually put that in there because they should have changed the language. In other words, it shouldn't be basically on disorderly behavior with the concurrence of 2/3. It needs to actually be an immediate removal, but I don't think the 2/3 is the threshold. I believe the whole language right here was changed and should have been changed by Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, and nobody wants to touch it because the day we can actually hold public servants accountable is the day the roosters, or I should say the chickens, come home to roost. Now, the next one is another violation. Each house shall keep a journal of its proceedings and from time to time publish the journal, excepting such parts as may be in their judgment require secrecy. I have a problem with this because I believe the state legislatures should be the ones to determine whether that secrecy is legitimate or not. I believe that we're now at a point where there's so much secrecy that the state legislature needs to step in and go, look, we need to be read in, and as a matter of fact, maybe we need to have an administrative committee of, you know, where we actually have people read in that actually oversee all of this to say, nope, you know what, we don't consider that a secret. Because I understand that we actually have to have gatekeepers and so forth, but when it comes to what they're doing, we're not talking about, you know, national secret contracts, operatives, or anything like that. We're talking about their day-to-day operations and the fact that they're in closed doors, you know, determining, you know, what stock to buy. And, you know, that's a secret meeting. Excuse me? So, again, I really see that the states really need to start asserting their authority now that they have the ability to engage at a minute's notice with Congress, with the federal government. Then the last part of this paragraph is, and the yeas and nays of the members of either house on any question shall, at the desire of 1/5 of those present, be entered on the journal. I honestly think that everything needs to be recorded, that there needs to be full transparency moving forward. Not just you have to have a 1/5 of the people say, hey, let's record the vote. And as a matter of fact, I think that the votes themselves need to be documented and published so that we, the people, actually can see. Because we obviously have been sleeping at the wheel for over a century, and we need to, you know, be far more engaged and more active in our government processes and so forth. Anyway, the last paragraph or clause, what have you, of Section 5, neither house, both the Senate and the House of Representatives, neither House during the session of Congress shall, without the consent of the other, adjourn for more than 3 days, nor to any other place that in which the two houses shall be sitting. So in other words, not being violated, just one of those things that, you know, they have the choice of being able to decide whether they're going to adjourn or not. And it can only, they can't adjourn for more than 3 days, right? Because that's what it says, no more than 3 days without, you know, fully adjourning, and it requires both houses to do that. Section 6. Now, a lot more problems, a lot more violations. The senators and representatives shall receive a compensation for their services to be ascertained by law and paid out of the Treasury of the United States. They're receiving compensation for, and they're talking about just basic compensation pay. They're not talking about benefits here. There's never been in the Constitution an allowance to give them benefits, health care, any type of benefits, travel. Now, compensation travel for official business and that type of stuff, but some of their allowances, you know, of having staff and so forth. That's not in here. They shall, in all cases, except treason, felony, and a breach of the peace, be privileged from arrest during their attendance at the session of their respective house, and in ongoing to and returning from the same. And for any speech or debate in either house, they shall not be questioned in any other place. So in other words, they're above the law, but they abuse this all the time. And this happens all the time, folks. So what do we do about this? I believe that they need to be somewhat above the law, but when it comes down to these treason, felony, breach of the peace, drunken disorder, breach of the peace is drunken disorderly. In other words, if you commit a crime, then you should be held accountable. And so suing them, and they've been basically hands off. They've been untouchable. They have been untouchable for centuries, because we were told, when we actually sued Congress, we were told that's the first time it's actually come out of a court where Congress was called by a summons to basically respond to the charges in the case. Interesting. Anyway, no senator or representative shall, during the time, this is also violated, shall, during the time for which he was elected, be appointed to any civil office under the authority of the United States, which shall have been created or emoluments whereof have been increased during such time. And no person holding any office under the United States shall be a member of either house during his continuance in office. So these things have been violated. John Rowlands has actually accounted for this, of how, you know, one particular person had been, you know, sitting in the Congress and actually having another role or responsibility. And this always goes to how, you know, they use and bend the rules so that they can obtain favors for those who they favor. And all of this is, we created a government that wasn't supposed to be able to do this. I mean, this is why this language is in the Constitution, for them not to do this. And they do it. All bills for raising revenue shall originate in the House of Representatives. And yet we see bills. So this is an egregious violation, because we see bills coming out of the Senate that, you know, are cost, you know, I should say, that are creating taxes. In other words, there are bills that are being originated by the Senate, and there's actually bills that are being originated by the president, of creating revenue. Remember Obamacare? So when we look at the whole process of how they've created, you know, some of these taxes and some of these bills where they're going to spend money, in other words, they spend money, they have to tax for it, it has not been out of the House each time. And so this is, what are we going to do? How are we going to get them to actually behave? Well, the best mechanism is not allowing them anymore to spend money on things they have no authority to spend money on. And getting back to strictly taxing over those powers that have been delegated. The tax for war, I mean, that's delegated. We're not even going to war. And we've got, you know, the commander in Dolt in the White House that is actually trying to march us into a war or into a conflict. He's deliberately setting the stage where America will have to defend itself. And I believe he's actually setting the stage where we capitulate, because his incompetency, I shouldn't even say his incompetency, I believe that that's what he's being directed to do. We don't have a president, we have a manager. We have a globalist manager sitting in that White House, and we haven't had a real president in over a century. We've had outliers, but we haven't had a real president well over a century, folks. That includes your Trump, that includes your Reagan, that includes Coolidge, and even Kennedy. But the Senate may propose or concur with amendments as on other bills. So in other words, The bills raising revenue, in other words, raising taxes, shall originate in the House of Representatives, but the Senate may propose or concur with amendments as on other bills. And oh, by the way, they like using treaties to create taxation and or ways of raising revenue. Every bill which shall have passed the House of Representatives and the Senate shall, before it become a law, be presented to the President of the United States. If he approves, he shall sign it, but if he shall not return it with his objections to that house in which it have originated, who shall enter the objection at large on their journal and proceed to reconsider it. If such reconsideration, two-thirds of that house, in other words, if he vetoes, and two-thirds of that house shall agree to pass the bill, it shall be sent together with the objections to the other house, by which it shall likewise be reconsidered, and if two-thirds approve that of that house, it shall become law. But in all cases, the votes of both houses shall be determined by yeas and nays, and the names of the persons voting for and against the bill shall be entered on the journal of each house respectively. If any bill shall not be returned by the president within 10 days, Sundays excepted, after it shall have been presented to him, the same shall be a law in like manner as if he had signed it, unless the Congress, by their adjournment, prevent its return, in which case it shall not be law. So in other words, if Congress creates a bill and they send it over to the president, and then they adjourn to just keep, you know, because the president says we're going, you know, he's going to veto it, and they adjourn, and they're not there for 10 days to receive that veto, then it does, you know, this rule doesn't apply. The veto stands, and they have to deal with it. But if they pass a law and it sits with the president, they're still in session for those 10 days. In other words, they can't adjourn after every bill, unless they can, but if they do and the president vetoes it, then that adjournment doesn't play. It doesn't play the way they would want to play it. Now, there are plenty of times where they do adjourn after a bill because they'll actually pass a bill and they know the president's going to sign it. So they go ahead and adjourn for Christmas or what have you. That many a times they've had the extension of the debt and they would extend the debt and then what? They would go off for a their Christmas break, summer break, or what have you. It's happened so many times that they do adjourn right after they have bills, but the only time that they have to be careful not to adjourn is if the president is not going to sign the bill. The next one, which is highlighted in yellow, every order, resolution, or vote to which the concurrence of the Senate and House of Representatives may be necessary, except on a question of adjournment, shall be presented to the President of the United States, and before the same shall take effect, shall be approved by him, or being disapproved by him, shall be repassed by two-thirds of the House of Representatives. So in other words, every resolution, every order, everything that Congress is going to do, it shall be passed by the president, and if not, then they have to basically overrule him. So when they do resolutions, they don't actually get his approval anymore. They just do it. And so this is why the president does executive orders on his own and uses, so they're each violating the separations of power. All three branches are violating the separations of power. And they've been doing it because nobody knows that they are not supposed to be doing it. Section 8. Now, Section 8, we got 4 minutes. And Section 8 is where the powers are given to the federal government. And when we say the federal government, powers are actually given to Congress because Congress has all the powers that are to be executed. The Supreme Court cannot execute, nor actually can the federal government execute. It actually is a part of their power of who has to execute, which is given to Congress. Congress has the trigger. They pull the trigger in executing, and we will get to that, because who executes the laws of the Union? The militia. So The very first line, this long little paragraph, it's not really long, but this three-plus liner, that Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, which was basically modified by the 16th Amendment to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States, but all duties, imposts, excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. Well, see, the 16th Amendment didn't touch that. And provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States, there's never been a power. That is not a power. That is a general assertion. And what happens is there's been many times where Congress has actually said, hey, we have this power to provide for the common defense and general welfare, and this is how we're going to provide these TARP bailouts for these insurance companies. This is how we're going to provide, you know, assistance to the Katrina victims through FEMA and so forth. They do not have the authority to use the purse for any type of emergency, any type of meltdown, crisis, or anything. This is a preamble that explains why the following powers are being provided. The most important part of this clause is the uniformity clause, that the federal government must be uniform in how it applies any taxation whatsoever. Now, some people say, well, if they actually provide grants where there's no power given to them to give grants, in other words, give the state money for a tornado or for a financial crisis like New York. Folks, you do realize that the trillions of dollars that were poured out of the federal government went into the state of New York because that's where all of the businesses were. Most all of them were there. In other words, New York got this disproportionate advantage by that. How is that even following the uniformity clause? They're saying, oh, well, they have this ability to do this, but I'm telling you, folks, they don't. That this is a preamble that explains why the following powers are being given. Then the real first power is to borrow money on the credit of the United States. Now, it doesn't say to create a bank. It says they can go to another country and borrow money on their own good faith and credit. To regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states. They cannot regulate the state's commerce. They can regulate commerce among the several states. In other words, how the states trade among each other, they're basically the cop to make sure that the states are playing fairly amongst each other. That's it. They do not have the ability to regulate your sink. They don't have the ability to regulate your toilet, your light bulbs. They have no authority or power delegated in this clause to regulate your water, irrigation system, anything that is a part of your commerce. Tires, your car, even the pollution coming from your car. They don't have that authority. It's not listed here. Anyway, and with the Indian tribes. So they include the ability to regulate, not among the Indian tribes, they have the ability to regulate commerce because that was considered foreign commerce. Anyway, we're going through the Constitution. We finally hit the powers. We'll kind of revisit what we just started off with in our next show tomorrow. So I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google Donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org and go to the contributions page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty.